Shadow Kill by Chris Ryan. Read by Barnaby Edwards. Chapter 1. Freetown, Sierra Leone, Thursday the 4th of May, 2000. 14:28 hours. Ronald Montague Soames, KBE, DSO, MC, was bricking it. It was an unfamiliar feeling for the former commanding officer of 22 SAS. You didn't spend 2 years running the regiment and 3 years as director special forces without growing brass balls, and Soames liked to think he had a bigger pair on him than most. But the stakes were higher today, much higher. As he sat at his polished walnut desk, counting down the seconds, Soames noticed his left hand twitching with anxiety. He swallowed hard and checked his Blancpain 50 fathoms for maybe the 100th time in the past few minutes. 2 minutes until the meeting. Not long to go now. His office was located on the first floor of a two-story colonial house on the Spur Road, pissing distance from the British High Commission. A worn leather chair faced the desk, and a tacky Victorian painting of a nude courtesan reclining on a chair hung from the wall. Cables snaked along the floor, leading to a Scion laptop, a fax machine, a telephone, and a printer. In one corner there was an old HF radio set. An overworked fan whirred noisily above, fighting a losing war against the thick 40-degree heat. The faded brass lettering on the office door was visible on the reverse side of the dirty glass. Ronald M. Soames, the lettering read. Director, Janus International. From his office window, Soames could see a chaotic sprawl of shanty huts and decrepit colonial buildings stretching all the way to the ocean, capped by a blanket of leaden clouds the colour of filthy rags. The office wasn't much to look at, and neither was the view, but then no one came to Sierra Leone to admire the scenery. They came for the same reason that had first brought Soames here 18 months earlier. Diamonds. The east of the country was overflowing with them, especially around Kono. The diamonds there were close to the surface, something to do with alluvial soil deposits, which meant you didn't need heavy, expensive machinery to drill down to the diamonds. You just needed a few guys with shovels and sieves for panning. It was cheap work, low overheads, big profits. But it also meant everyone was competing for a slice of the action, and whoever controlled the mines controlled Sierra Leone. It was like the gold rush, the oil boom, and the Colombian drug trade all rolled into one. No government could run the country without controlling the diamond mines, and the place was awash with private military companies, which is where Ronald Soames came in. His PMC had been awarded a contract to provide security for the biggest diamond mine in Kono. It should have been a straightforward gig. The rebel fighters in the Revolutionary United Front were poorly armed, shoddily trained and undisciplined. They stood no chance against the 50 or so ex-Blades, former South African recces, and local guards on Janus's payroll. Plus, the country's president had the backing of the Yanks as well as the Brits, which meant he stood a better chance than most of clinging on to power. But recently, things had started going south, big time. The rebels began making inroads in the south of the country. The president had panicked and legged it across the border to Conakry, Guinea. His supporters had quickly melted away. The money had started to dry up. All of a sudden, protecting the diamond mines in Kono didn't seem quite so straightforward or lucrative. All of which worried Soames. He wasn't getting much sleep, and he was drinking more than normal. The stress of the situation getting under his skin like a surgical knife. But in those darker moments, Soames liked to remind himself that he also had his own operation, a nice little earner on the side. He liked to think of it as a sort of insurance policy, a way of protecting his interests in Sierra Leone. It was his secret. No one else associated with Janus International knew about his operation, and Soames preferred to keep it that way. He had a reputation to protect, after all. He was a respected fixer inside Whitehall, the go-to man for the establishment and several key ministers. Play his cards right, and a year from now, at the age of 53, he could be more powerful than ever. He'd have a direct line to the next Prime Minister and maybe even a seat in the House of Lords. For 18 months, Soames had managed to keep his activities hidden from the authorities. No one had suspected a damn thing. There were rumours, of course, but in a festering shithole like Sierra Leone, there were always rumours. No one paid them any notice. No one had anything on Soames that could damage him. He was practically untouchable. Until a week ago, when the Russian had reached out to him, told him he knew what Soames was up to in Sierra Leone, claimed he had evidence, witnesses, proof, threatened to ruin Soames unless he handed over the spoils, gave him 7 days to decide. Soames had spent the past week weighing up his options. He'd thought about calling in a few favours back home. He had plenty of friends in high places. He was one of the most decorated officers in the British Army, a recipient of the Military Cross for his actions in Belfast, and on first-name terms with the Queen. People owed him, especially since Soames had cleaned up many of their own problems in the past. But he realised he couldn't ask for their help this time. On the sixth evening, Soames made up his mind. He wasn't going to be pushed around by this Russian bastard. He would do what he did best, fix the problem himself. The Russian arrived 60 seconds later. Soames heard the screech of the guy's Mercedes pulling up just inside the gate, followed by the suck and thud of a car door opening and shutting. Maybe 30 seconds passed. Then the houseboy appeared at the office door and rapped twice. Soames closed his eyes, took in a deep breath and exhaled. Then he popped open his eyes and called for the Russian to enter. Viktor Agron strode powerfully into the office, like he owned the fucking place. The guy looked like a football hooligan who'd landed a job at Bear Stearns. He was big and muscular and shaven-headed, with a tattoo on his thick neck showing a wolf's head baring its teeth. The kind of tattoo you got when you joined a Russian biker gang. The guy must have weighed north of 150 kilos, Soames figured. His massive frame was crammed into a plain two-piece suit and white shirt with the collar button popped, and an arrogant smirk ran across his lips, like the quick stroke of a knife. He had a Breitling watch clamped around his left wrist, like an oversized silver handcuff. Soames nodded at the houseboy. "Leave us, Vandy." Vandy bowed and turned to leave. Agron waited until the houseboy had closed the door behind him. Then he swaggered over to the chair opposite Soames and sat down, man-spreading his legs. A tense silence lingered in the air, like meat from a butcher's hook.
"I'm surprised you're still here, Ronald," Agron said.
He spoke in a thick, slow tone of voice that sounded like wading through mud. Soames made a sound deep in his throat and shrugged.
"You thought I'd run?" "It crossed my mind," the Russian replied. "Haven't you heard the reports on the radio? The rebels are 50 kilometers from Freetown now. If they take the city, we both know what will happen to you." "The rebels won't make it this far. They never do."
"You'd better hope you're right."
Agron flashed a shit-eating grin.
"You're one of President Fofana's closest advisors, after all. I doubt they'd show someone in your position any mercy."
Soames glared at the Russian.
"You came alone, I trust."
"As agreed. But I wouldn't get any clever ideas. My people are everywhere. We have this place surrounded."
Soames cleared his throat and said,
"I've been thinking about your offer."
Agron smiled.
"Hand over your little business operation in Kono, and in return, we'll keep it a secret between us. No one else ever has to know." "Those were the terms, I believe. More than reasonable. Well, have you made a decision?"
Soames hesitated. His mouth was suddenly very dry.
"My answer is no. We don't have a deal."
Agron furrowed his brow. He looked pissed off. He remained silent for what felt like a long time, but was probably no more than 2 or 3 seconds.
"That's disappointing," the Russian said at last. "Extremely disappointing. But I had a feeling you'd say that."
He sighed.
"In that case, you'll leave me no choice. We have to do things the hard way."
Soames let out a snort. "Is that supposed to be a threat?" Agron shrugged and held out his palms, like he had a bag of coins in each hand and was trying to decide which one was the heaviest.
"Not a threat, Ronald. I'm just laying out the bare facts. We made you a fair offer. Actually, more than fair. You foolishly refused it. Since you have no intention of giving me what we want, I'm going to have to take it from you, by force. I'd like to see you try."
A smile crept out of the corner of Agron's mouth.
"Actually, we already are."
"What's that supposed to mean?" Soames demanded.
"At this very moment, friends of mine are on their way to the border. The kind of friends you don't mess with. They have orders to take everything from you. Your entire business."
The Russian sat back and folded his arms across his chest, pleased with himself.
"We're going to clean you out."
The news hit Soames like a fist. He clamped his jaw shut and stared at the Russian.
"Bullshit! You don't know where to look."
"Maybe not," Agron replied, shrugging. "But you're going to tell us."
"And why the hell would I do that?"
Agron's smile widened.
"Because otherwise I'm going to put a call into the British High Commissioner and tell him everything we know. Give him all the evidence, every last bit. What we know is enough to sink your career. Once word gets back to London, you'll be finished."
Fear crawled up Soames's spine, chilling the nape of his neck. He shook his head.
"No, the ball is still in your court," said Agron. "Hand over your business, and the High Commissioner won't find out what you've been doing. You can still save your own skin."
"Fuck you,"
Soames snapped. The Russian chuckled.
"No, Ronald. It is you who is fucked. Supremely fucked, in fact. Like the horse in this town, no?"
He winked at Soames.
"You know what you must do. Give us what we want. It's your only way out."
The voice at the back of Soames's head said, "You can make this problem go away. You know what you have to do." Soames sighed and nodded briskly at the Russian.
"If we're going to negotiate, then at least let's be civilized about it. How about something to drink? I have a bottle of Grey Goose somewhere."
Agron's eyes lit up.
"Now you're speaking my language. Do you have any idea how hard it is to find good vodka in this fucking country?"
Soames smiled as he slid out from behind his desk. He paced over to the drinks cabinet in the far corner of the office. He kept a ready supply of spirits in the office in case of an emergency. In Sierra Leone, bribery was a way of life. Police officers, soldiers, government lackeys, they all had to be bought off before anything could get done. Some people paid with American dollars or the local currency. Others used cigarettes. Soames preferred to buy people off with bottles of Chivas Regal and Laphroaig. He reached for the bottle of Grey Goose. Next to it was an industrial-strength plastic cable tie formed into a wide loop roughly the circumference of a human neck. It was the kind of thing you use to bind together a bunch of electric wires. Soames had purchased a pack of cable ties a few weeks earlier, intending to clean up the spaghetti network of wires that crisscrossed the office floor. But he'd never got around to the job. Now the cable tie was going to come in handy. He paused and glanced past his shoulder, making sure Agron still had his back turned to him. The guy was glancing down at his Breitling, as if he was in a big hurry to be somewhere else. Breathing hard, Soames reached out and grabbed the bottle of Grey Goose by the neck. He snatched up the length of cable tie with his free hand. Then he turned and paced slowly over to Agron until he was standing directly behind the guy, throwing shadows over his back. The Russian half turned in his chair, looked up at Soames, saw the bottle, saw the cable tie, screwed up his face.
What the fuck do you...
He didn't get a chance to finish the sentence. In a blur of movement, Soames swung his left arm back and brought the vodka bottle crashing against the side of Agron's skull. The bottle made a satisfying metallic clink as it thunked against hard bone, like an aluminium bat smashing a baseball out of the park. Agron made a dull sound in his throat and spilled out of the chair. His flailing arms scattered papers everywhere as he crashed to the ground, his head smacking against the tiled floor. Soames was on top of him in a flash. He worked fast, taking the looped end of the cable tie and pulling it down over Agron's head as the guy lay writhing on his front. Then he took the other end of the cable and pulled it as tight as it would go. The cable tie made a rasping sound as it fastened around Agron's neck, constricting his airway. Soames crouched over Agron as the guy struggled to breathe. The Russian managed to haul himself to his knees, groaning and gasping for air. His eyes bulged until they were the size of saucepans. He lifted his hands to his neck and tried digging his fingers under the cable tie in a desperate effort to prise it free. But the tie was pulled tight. The plastic started cutting into the thick folds of his flesh, like wire through a block of cheese. No way to loosen it. No way at all. Agron took a long time to die. His face shaded red, then purple, then blue. He collapsed to the floor, his fingers still clawing at the cable tie. Snot bubbled under his flared nostrils. He made a desperate, rasping sound deep in his throat as the fight began to seep out of him. His black leather shoes scraped against the floor in his death throes, leaving scuff marks on the polished tiles. A jagged row of black lines, like a prisoner marking off days on a cell wall. 20 seconds later, Agron stopped breathing. Soames waited a few beats. A thick stench of piss and shit slowly filled the air from where the Russian had voided his bowels in the last few seconds of his life. Fighting his gag reflex, Soames dropped to one knee and felt for a pulse. Nothing. Soames felt no remorse. As far as he was concerned, the Russian had it coming. The guy had signed his death warrant the moment he'd tried to blackmail Soames. Well, fuck him. Now what? Soames asked himself. Get rid of him, then get to Kono, before the Russians get there and rob me. The first part of the plan was easy enough. He knew how to make Agron disappear. Strip the guy of his wallet, watch and clothes, drag the body outside, shove him in the back of the Land Rover. There was a 2-meter-high wall enclosing the property, high enough that none of his neighbours would be able to see him taking the body out into the front yard. Then Soames would drive out of the city and dump Agron on the side of the road, somewhere outside McKenney. It would take days before the authorities discovered the body. Even then, they would simply assume that the guy had been killed in a roadside ambush, a classic case of wrong place, wrong time. The roads outside Freetown were heaving with armed rebels, hopped up on ganja and poyo, the local brew. Westerners were forever getting attacked. By the time Agron's body was found, Soames would have reached Kono, cleaned the place out and covered his tracks. 24 hours from now, he could be out of the country, relaxing with a cool beer in Cape Town. He reached over to remove the guy's breitling and froze. A thin wire was sticking out of the side of the watch, no thicker than a strand of human hair, and alternately coloured red and white. The striped wire ran from just above the breitling crowns and snaked under the Russian's jacket sleeve, which is why Soames hadn't seen it before now. Agron had kept it hidden from view. But as soon as Soames set eyes on the wire, he knew exactly what he was looking at. A locator beacon. He'd seen them before. The antenna transmitted a signal location on a specific frequency, picked up by whoever was monitoring activity on the other end. My people are everywhere, Agron had said. We have this place surrounded. The door flung open. Soames looked up. Vandy stood in the doorway, his skinny features stitched with anxiety. For a moment, the houseboy didn't say a word. He glanced over at the dead body and stiffened. Then he lifted his terrified gaze back to Soames and pointed frantically towards the window.
"Men coming, Mr. Ronald!"
Vandy exclaimed.
"Look!"
Soames moved past the kid and rushed over to the window overlooking the front of the property. A pair of white Toyota Corollas were racing through the main gate 25 meters away, steering past the derelict garden. They skidded to a halt directly outside the house, 10 meters away from the old Land Rover 110 Soames used to tool around the city. In the next instant, the passenger doors on both Corollas flung open, and four guys debussed, two from each vehicle. All four were decked out in safari gear and designer shades, and they were all brandishing stubby-looking pistols. PSM semi-automatics, Soames realized. Soviet-designed pieces, popular with the KGB back in the day, chambered for the 5.45x18mm round. One of those dependable Russian firearms that never went out of fashion in the Third World. The four gunmen barreled towards the main door 15 meters away. Soames looked on for a cold beat. Shit. The Russians' friends, he realized. They're coming for me. There was no time to lose. He spun away from the window, his mind racing ahead. He had 8 or 9 seconds before the gunman came bursting into the office. The lizard part of his brain kicked into gear, told him to forget about hiding the dead body. There was no time to cover his tracks. He had to get out of the house right this fucking instant. But how? The front door was out of the question, clearly. He could try bolting up the stairs and hiding in the roof, but the gunman already knew where to look for him. It would only be a matter of time before they discovered his hiding place. No, Soames told himself, there's only one thing for it. He sprang into action, sprinted past the desk and the dead Russian. Vandy thrust out his arms, pleading with his master to let him tag along. Soames shoved the kid aside, yelling at him to get out of his way. He ran towards the balcony at the far end of the office, his heart beating fast inside his chest. Behind him, a chorus of angry shouts echoed in the stairwell, interspersed with the pounding of heavy boots on the treads. The voices were getting louder. The gunmen were closing in. 6 seconds until they barged into the office, Soames figured. 5. On 4 seconds, he hit the balcony door. Soames ripped it open and stepped out onto the balcony. The heat closed in on him. He leaned over the ledge and looked down. The balcony overlooked a garden at the rear of the property, littered with weeds and rusted bits of garden furniture, and surrounded by a crumbling brick wall topped with razor wire to keep the local criminals out. Beyond the wall, Soames could just about see a maze of dilapidated huts in the nearby slum, their corrugated tin roofs gleaming like loose change under the dull glow of the sun. There, if anywhere, he might hope to lose his pursuers. 3 seconds to go. Soames gripped the ledge with both hands and swung his left leg over the railing. There was a drop of 7 meters from the balcony to the ground below, high enough to hurt like fuck, but low enough to risk jumping down. He started to bring his right leg over the railing, holding onto the ledge with both hands. To his left, he glimpsed Vandy diving inside the rickety wardrobe in a futile attempt to hide from the gunman. Soames could hear voices on the other side of the door now. The Russians were almost at the office door. Soames took a breath. Then he swung his right leg over, releasing his grip just as the gunman kicked in the door and came storming into the room. He fell hard, landing on his side on the parched, dry ground. It was like being thrown into the path of an onrushing truck. A jarring pain exploded in his shoulder and shot up into his skull. Soames felt something crack in his upper chest, like a branch snapping in half. His jaw ached. His legs felt as if someone had dropped a stack of breeze blocks on them. He lay on the ground for a moment, badly winded. Then the voice inside his head screamed at him, "Get up! Keep fucking moving!" Soames forced himself to his feet, wincing with pain. It hurt to breathe, it hurt to move. A sharp pain sparked up inside his chest, and he wondered if he'd broken a rib. He forced himself to push through it, shoved it aside and moved on, stumbling through the weeds as he headed for the eastern side of the house, 10 meters away. His only hope of escape was to tack down the side path leading to the front of the house, get to the landy, and speed out of the main gate before the gunman could figure out what the fuck was going on. It wasn't much of a plan, he knew, but it was either that or surrender, and if the gunman arrested him, he was as good as dead. Then Soames heard a shout at his 6 o'clock. He glanced past his shoulder and spotted one of the gunmen rushing onto the balcony. The guy pointed at Soames, then hollered at his muckers behind him in the office. Then he brought his PSM to bear. Soames stood frozen to the spot for a split second. The PSM muzzle flashed. Dirt fizzed up into the air half a meter behind Soames as the bullet struck the ground. The gunman readjusted his aim. The other voices grew louder as the rest of the gunmen rushed towards the balcony. Soames quickly unfroze. He turned and ran on as the Russian fired again. He heard another pistol crack behind him, the thud of the bullet thumping into the hot, dry earth. Soames ran faster. In the next instant, he hit the corner, then hurried down the rubbish-strewn path leading towards the front of the house. He could see the Land Rover parked up ahead in the middle of the drive, 20 meters away. Not far to go now, he told himself. His heart was beating so fast he could feel it thumping inside his throat. The pain in his chest dialed down to a faint ache. Fear and adrenaline flooded into his bloodstream, temporarily numbing the pain. 10 meters to the driveway, 15 meters to the Land Rover. Almost there, don't give up now. The Land Rover was parked side-on in front of the house, with the driver's side door located on the far side of the wagon from the entrance. Soames rushed past the front of the house and reached the Land Rover in half a dozen ragged strides. He swept around to the side door, gasping for breath, as he frantically dug his keys out of his cargo trouser pocket. Then he yanked open the door and dived behind the steering wheel, as footsteps sounded from the front entrance to the house. Soames shoved the key into the ignition and cranked the engine. The Landy sputtered into life. He glanced across at the side window to his right and saw two of the gunmen surging out of the front door, their semi-automatic pistols raised. The other two gunmen were 3 meters further back and hurrying forward to join their mates. The two nearest gunmen were less than 12 meters from the Landy, which put them well within the PSM's maximum effective range. "Fucking move!" Soames told himself. The two nearest gunmen fired. Their muzzles flashed, and a pair of cracks rumbled across the driveway. Soames ducked his head below the dash as the rounds hammered against the side of the Landy, pinballing through the chassis and shredding metal. He stayed low as four more bullets whipped across the driveway and hammered against the side of the wagon. A fifth round smashed like a fist through the passenger side window, shattering the glass and spilling hundreds of fragments across the seat opposite Soames. There was a momentary lull in the shooting. The gunmen must be zeroing in their aim, Soames figured. Adrenaline took over. He shunted the Landy into first gear and put his foot to the gas pedal. The Landy growled, then accelerated towards the main gate, 15 meters away at the far end of the driveway, putting distance between himself and the four gunmen. Soames glanced up at the rear view. The four gunmen were at his 6 o'clock now, 12 meters behind him. Now 14 meters behind him. Now 16. 11 meters to the gate, thought Soames. 10 meters. 9. The Landy rocketed towards the gate. 8 meters to go now. Behind Soames, the four gunmen started pissing bullets at the Landy. Most of the rounds were wildly off target. A trio of bullets slapped into the brick wall either side of the gate, tearing out chunks of mortar and spitting hot dust into the air. One of the rounds thumped into the front passenger seat. Another zipped through the hole in the rear windscreen and narrowly whistled past Soames's head, spider-cracking the front windscreen. For a terrifying moment, Soames thought he was going to die. He kept going. The gunmen were running across the driveway, chasing after the Landy. But they were losing ground. The gap between the shooters and Soames was 20 meters. 6 meters to the gate. He started to believe he was going to make it. I'm going to give these Russian bastards the slip. He was 5 meters from the entrance when he glimpsed a blur of movement in his peripheral vision. A third Toyota Corolla came hurtling down the spur road towards the front of the open gate. Same model and colour as the two vehicles parked in front of the house, Soames realised. Two white guys sat in the front seats, decked out in the same clothes as the four Russian gunmen. He instantly grasped who they were. Backup. The Russians must have kept a third team stationed outside the house in case Soames tried to make a run for it. Now the guys in the third Corolla were moving forward to block him off in front of the gate, cutting off his only escape route and trapping him inside the grounds of the house. The Corolla screeched to a halt in front of the gates, directly in front of the Land Rover. Soames floored the gas, aiming straight for the Corolla. The Landy engine roared throatily. The needle on the speedometer climbed fast. There was a violent crunch and shudder as the Landy smashed into the front end of the smaller car. The Corolla's front wheels briefly lifted as the Land Rover rammed past the vehicle, the force of the impact crumpling the bonnet and punching out the headlights. The Landy swept past the Corolla, then bolted out through the gate, lurching onto the main road. Soames hit the brakes and wrenched the steering wheel hard to the right, narrowly avoiding a row of battered old motors parked on the opposite side of the road. He felt the full weight of the wagon pulling to the right, the tires shrieking, the frame juddering. The Land Rover swerved away from the line of parked cars and straightened out, pointing north on the spur road. Soames glanced across at his 3 o'clock and saw the damaged Corolla resting next to the main gate. The front end of the motor looked like a beer can somebody had crushed. Smoke fluted up from the engine. Glass was strewn across the ground in front of the motor. Behind the Corolla, Soames caught sight of the 4 Russian gunmen as they raced towards the gate. 2 of the Russians headed for one of the Corollas parked in the driveway. The other 2 sprinted forward and swept around the smashed-up Corolla, their PSMs raised at the Land Rover as they prepared to blast up the wagon. Soames didn't fuck about. He mashed the pedal. The Landy fishtailed as it pulled away from the house, quickly picking up speed. Soames heard the crackle of gunfire to his rear as the 2 gunmen ran into the street and loosed off 6 rounds at the departing wagon. The bullets hammered against the back of the Landy, ricocheting off the bodywork. Soames kept flooring it, burning rubber as he put more distance between himself and the Russians. The speedometer needle climbed above 50 miles per. One of the gunmen unloaded another 3-round burst. Soames didn't see where the bullets landed, didn't care. He kept the Landy pointed north, leaving the shooters in his wake. The gunmen were 150 metres behind him now. The needle soared past the 60 mark. 200 metres. He saw one of the Corollas pulling out into the main road, tyres screeching as it swerved past the damaged car. The 2 gunmen in the road lowered their weapons and dived into the back seats of the Corolla. A second later, the vehicle rocketed forward, giving chase. Soames kept his foot to the gas, driving as hard as he dared. The Corolla was a speck in the rear view, but the gap was steadily closing, and Soames knew he had to get off the main road before the Russians caught up with him. After 200 metres, he passed the Mamba Point guest house and hung a hard right, turning off the main street. The road suddenly degraded. A rancid stench filled the Land Rover, garbage rotting in the tropical heat. The wagon rocked as it bounced over deep potholes. Heaps of rotting vegetables and rubbish lined both sides of the road. Everything here was brown, the homes, the road, the people. He made a series of quick turns through the back streets, his eyes locked on the rearview mirror, looking for any sign of the enemy. Nothing. Soames figured he had lost the Russians, but he didn't want to take any chances. He took another sharp turn and then pulled over next to a line of corrugated tin shacks. He killed the engine, booted open the door, and jumped out of the bullet-riddled wagon. I've got to ditch the vehicle. The Land Rover was hot, Soames knew, and there weren't many 110 defenders inside the city. Driving it around would make him stand out like a sore thumb. No, he would have to continue his journey on foot. He hurried down the street, ignoring the hostile looks from the locals, constantly glancing over his shoulder to make sure the Russians hadn't followed him. The heat was unbearable, like being smothered with a hot towel. Sweat pasted his shirt to his back and dripped into his eyes. His mouth tasted dry. His body cried out for a brief rest, just to catch his breath. But he didn't stop. He knew he had to keep going. I might have lost the Russians, Soames thought, but my troubles are only just beginning. For a start, he'd had to leave a dead body in his office. Now the Russian security services were on his case, and they weren't the kind of people who would let him get away with killing one of their own. They would hunt for Soames, in force, and they wouldn't stop until they found him. Which meant that right now he was the most wanted man in Sierra Leone. He had no passport, no money, no gun. He'd had to abandon everything in the office when Victor Agren's friends showed up. Soames knew he would have to get to Kono before the Russians found out where he'd hidden everything and robbed him blind. which would be difficult enough in ordinary circumstances, but now he was a wanted man in the most dangerous city on Earth. There were about a dozen checkpoints and 200 miles of rebel-held territory between Freetown and the diamond mine at Kono. He couldn't head there any time soon. It was too dangerous. There were too many people looking for him. The whole city was on the cusp of a rebel coup. No, Soames told himself, Kono would have to wait. First of all, he had to find a friend. 16 hours later, John Porter's pager buzzed.